a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Representative Hunt, we are now on the internet, and I think you can ask for the meeting to commence, and we can take roll.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Decker. This is Representative Roger Hunt, Chairman of the Rules Review Committee, and I'm assuming that we are online as far as South Dakota Public Television and Radio is concerned. So we'll call this meeting to order, and we will ask the Secretary to call the roll.
Gibson.
Here.
Hunstead.
Here.
Hunhoff.
Here.
Lust.
Here.
Valley.
Here.
Hunt.
Here. We have a quorum. I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of our July meeting.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hunt, I so move.
Seconds that motion.
We have a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting made by Representative Gibson, approved or seconded by Senator Hunstead. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of our last meeting will say aye. Those opposed, no. Secretary, call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye. The minutes are approved. Mr. Decker, do we have any staff report?
Chairman Hunt, no report at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Decker. Are there any questions by any members of the committee with regards to the agenda? Hearing none, we'll proceed to go directly to our rules review. And we will have as our first presenter the Department of Labor State Plumbing Commission. And I'm assuming the proponent and presenter is in peer. And if they would just come forward at this time and please identify yourself and begin your presentation with regards to the changes relative to the Uniform Plumbing Code. Mr. Decker, do we?
Okay.
We do. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Richards. I'm director for the State Plumbing Commission. Here to go over some of the rules that the commission passed at its meeting held in July, on July 22nd. If you have your packets with you, I'll start on page 1, beginning with rule 2053-0307. What this does is changes the format of our plumbing exam. Basically, no changes. It just reverses the open book and the closed book part. And then down towards the bottom of the page, we used to have a rule that said if you received over 80% on your journeyman exam, you didn't have to write the contractor exam. The commission has repealed that. However, everybody that qualified under that rule previously will be grandfathered in. Does anybody have any questions on that?
This is the chairman. Just go ahead and run through your rules, and we will allow time for questioning at the end of your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going to page 2 and 3, the next change basically is on page 3. We're changing the cost of a plumbing permit from $2 to $5. And basically, the $2 just hardly covers the printing of the form along with the postage of mailing them. It's a four-part form. So that's what that change does. And then continuing on to page 3 and 4, 2053-1003, the commission is going to a flat inspection fee of $40 for residential and $200 for commercial. They had proposed 50 for residential, but it amended it at the hearing. So the result is going to be $17,000 less in revenue than what was projected on the fiscal note. And that would also affect the budget balance that BFM predicted, which was $72,000. It'll now be $55,000 come June 30th, 2011. And then the last page is pages 5 through 23, which basically changes the 2003 Uniform Plumbing Code to the 2009, along with several amendments to that code. Those were the four changes that the commission made at the hearing.
Do you have any further part of your presentation?
That concludes it, unless you have any questions.
All right, at this time, we will take questions of the members of the committee of the proponent and then go on to any other proponents and opponents. But let's take this time to question the presenter. Members of the committee, go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Valley.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. One of them is, what is the status of the dollars in the fund that you have for the Plumbing Commission, you know, like your revenues and expenses? I saw the revenues here from the past. I mean, it appeared to me we're raising the residential. Well, now it's only going to be about $3, but before it was about a 30% increase to 50, and the commercial was 300% up to 200. So could you kind of go through that, what the need for the increase is?
Well, the need for the total increase is our budget balance has declined the last 3 years to where we're in quite a crisis, actually. Like I say, originally we proposed $50 for residential. We backed it off to 40, and we just want to take the bigger hit on the commercial side, try to relieve the homeowners of additional costs.
Senator Valley, continue.
Could you just give me a quick summary of where that fund is at, how much is in it, and how much you spend a year, so I can kind of get an idea? You say you're in deep trouble. That didn't really answer my question.
Okay. For the past fiscal year, we had a expenditure budget of $548,000.
Okay.
And our revenues for that same period were $452,000. And this has been the trend for the last few years. Yeah, we're looking at the same situation for this fiscal year as well. Our expenditures are going to exceed our revenues without an increase. Presently, as of August 31st, where we're at right now, I'd say our fund balance is right around $50,000.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please, go ahead.
So we're approximately running 100,000 short a year, and this will raise an additional 55,000 bucks. 50. Are we still going to have a problem here?
No, we think with our continuing education seminars, which we have authority to charge for, we'll gain an additional 20,000 to 30,000 from that. So I think we'll be okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions by any of the committee members?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gibson, or is it Senator Hunoff?
It's Senator Hunoff.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Just to go back to the financials, I guess I'm sort of on that track. I'm looking at your fund balance sheet that came out, Now, it says beginning cash on balance is $108,000. So what you're saying is then that's what's going to be left, or what you're projecting in 2011 then that you'll still have, and then $72,000 left. Is that correct?
That's the projected balance as of June 30th, 2011. Correct. $72,000.
Okay. I'm lost here. If you're generating 55 and maybe another 30, 80,000, that's only 150, 60,000, and you're running disbursements of 545. So where are you making up the difference?
Well, our disbursements for this coming fiscal year is, I believe it's about 580,000. The 548 was for the previous fiscal year.
Okay, so I'm still not where you're getting enough revenue to support your operations then.
Well, we didn't want to raise them any higher than we had to, but just enough to limp along for a couple more years, and if we need to adjust again, then we'll have to look at that or figuring out some cutbacks in our expenditures.
So as we're projecting out, even in 2011, and then what you're looking at 2012, you're going to be running in the red.
It'll be getting close.
Well, that's your commission, but certainly there. I would hope that when it comes to 2012, that there's some plan in there that how you're going to recover, or if you're going to have some reductions there, realizing it's an informational budget, but I'm sure there's going to be some questions asked.
Yeah, we'll have to address that through the legislature. See, the fees we've proposed we're maxed at those numbers in statute right now.
Thank you.
Are there any other further questions by the members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Representative Gibson.
Representative Gibson, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, can you tell me, I'm looking at your Department of Labor Plumbing Commission condition statement here, and just as Senator Hunhoff said, it's not making a lot of sense to me. And what are these fees? These fees are just your inspection fees and your continuing education fees. Not being a person on appropriations, I don't have the information that I need probably to discern what these fees are used for. And can you just give me a little education on this issue, please?
These are inspection fees only. And they support an inspection staff of 5 inspectors who are located in different parts of the state. And the rest of the expenditures are funded by license fees.
Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee? If not, then we'll see if there are any further proponents. Are there any other proponents? Any other proponents? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Are there any opponents? Seeing none, we'll close the committee hearing on this set of rules, taking a public testimony, and we'll move to committee discussion and or action on these proposed rules by the State Plumbing Commission.
Representative Lutz moves approval.
Okay. Representative Lutz moves approval. Is there a second?
Second, Senator Hunstad.
Seconded by Senator Hunstad. Any discussion on that motion to approve? Seeing, hearing none, all those in favor of that motion will say aye. Those opposed, nay. The Secretary will call the roll.
Gibson. Hunstad?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye. Majority approves the rules, therefore the rules go forth with an approved recommendation. We'll now move to Representative Gibson. We'll shift the proverbial gavel to her to take the Next set of rules dealing with the Department of Social Services. Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Chairman Hunt. Will the presenter please come forward, identify yourself, the name of your organization you represent, and begin testimony on this set of rules involving the Department of Social Services, and explain the rule changes to all of those listening in the committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Laura Ringling, Department of Social Services. In summary, this package of rules centralizes the list of covered services requiring prior authorization and remove the specific criteria necessary for authorization of each service, remove gastric bypass, gastric stapling, gastroplasty, and similar procedures from the list of non-covered services, add liver transplants to the list of covered organ transplants for adults, and revise the time limits for submission of claims. These rules also update definitions, internal references, and other unclear or obsolete language. The hearing on these rules was held on August 3, 2010. No comments were received on the proposed rules at the hearing or in writing after the hearing. With that, I'll stand by for any questions you may have.
Representative Gibson, we're not hearing you with your...
I'm sorry. Are there other proponents to these rules, or are there questions of this presenter by members of the committee?
Chairman Gibson, Representative Hunt, I just have one question.
Go ahead, sir.
Looking at the fiscal impact, it would appear that the state's share of the additional cost for this is going to be something in excess of $200,000. I assume that's in the budget someplace.
Yes, that was part of our fiscal year 2011 budget.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam
Are
Chair?
There further questions of members of the committee? Senator Hunhoff, or Senator Hunstead, or Hunhoff, excuse me.
Thank you. Just a follow-up to Representative Hunt. What are you planning for numbers when you projected those numbers for people needing those transplants?
Thank you, Representative, or Senator Hunhoff. We projected that there would be approximately 2 transplants per year.
Follow up. Were those transplants, is that one heart and one liver, or are you, I mean, is that what you're looking at?
No, that was 2 liver transplants. Heart transplants are currently covered.
Follow up, Senator Hunhoff?
One more, okay?
Okay.
I'm just looking at the heart transplants, the rule number, update, remove criteria for covered heart. So what does that mean?
That means that we are removing the criteria necessary to receive a covered heart transplant out of rule, and we're going to move that into policy online.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there further questions of the committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt.
Go ahead, Representative Hunt.
Follow up to Senator Hunhoff's question. You say this is projected for 2 liver transplants. What's the history over the last 5 years as far as interest or requests for liver transplants? How did you decide on 2? What's magic about 2 a year? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. I'm going to call upon our Division Director, Larry Iverson, to answer that question for you.
Good morning, members of the committee. Larry Iverson, Department of Social Services. I am the Medicaid director. Representative Hunt, we looked at basically national averages for liver transplants to come up with who we currently have on our rolls in terms of total eligibles in the state for Medicaid, and then applied national averages to the number of liver transplants that occur in a population. We have had, I would say, over the last 2 to 3 years, probably somewhere between 3 and 4 requests to cover adult liver transplants.
And just to follow up, so if you've had 3 or 4 requests in past years, and you're only going to, in essence, budget for half of that number, is that realistic?
Representative Hunt, that's in total, not over each year. So I would say over the last 2 to 3 years, we've had somewhere between 3 and 4 requests.
Okay, thank you. I misunderstood. Thank you very much for that clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lust, did you have questions as well?
I do, Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Ringling, I'm just looking on page 13 about removal of a gastric bypass and stapling, et cetera. What factors and what criteria do you review in taking something like that off the not covered list?
Ms. Ringling?
Yes, Representative Lust. Gastric bypass, gastric stapling, and gastroplasty are currently being covered when medically necessary. This rule change is just a cleanup from years past.
If I may follow up, just in general, you've got a list of things that are not covered. How do you go about determining what is on that list and what is not?
I have a question just so we can get answer your question. Are you asking about what gets on the list for what we prior authorize, or specifically speaking to gastric bypass?
No, just a list in general.
Okay.
How do you determine what's in and what's out?
Sure. We look at, number one, the cost of the procedures, sometimes whether the procedures can be done in-state or out-of-state. Certainly, procedures such as transplants, oftentimes those occur out-of-state, depending on the transplant. And so those are a couple of the factors that we look at in determining whether a particular procedure or service needs to be put onto a prior authorization list.
Very good. Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Lust?
No, thank you.
Are there other questions of committee members for these
Chair,
proponents?
Madam Chair, Senator Valley.
Senator Valley, go ahead.
I'm going to follow up to Representative Lust. I don't know that I understood that. Are we talking? What I'm interested in is not each individual case, but why we decide that gastric bypass is something that should be included, or why liver transplant should be included, and why not to include them on the things we're going to cover. It sounded like that was an individual case, whether it's in-state or out-of-state. I'm just wondering, is there some set of rules from Medicaid that say these are optional that you can cover, these are not, these are ones you have to take care of? That's what I'm trying to get at. Can you help me there?
Hopefully I can help you understand better, Senator Valley. Take, for example, liver transplants for adults. We have always covered liver transplants for children. That's required by federal law because it's a child. Until in the last few years, liver transplants for adults had been experimental. Medicare considered them to be experimental, so we didn't cover them because we don't cover experimental procedures. They are no longer considered to be experimental, and so then we chose to cover them. Because we had seen a number of cases where Medicaid folks over the last few years did request liver transplants as an adult, and we were not able to assist those people because we could not cover them. And so that's why we were seeking to make this particular change.
Follow up, Madam Chair. And that decision is made by, is there a group that does that, or is that the secretary and staff? Who makes that decision is what is going to go from non-covered to covered?
The secretary and staff, and we also consult with medical professionals.
Is there Are there any other questions of the committee? Senator Valley, did you have a follow-up to that?
I don't think so.
Mr. Iverson, may I ask
Gibson?
A question? Yes, go ahead, Senator. Go ahead, Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. You know, I'm just really curious here. As you're moving around and now providing that these services are on your covered list, how were you, and you say there's no change to the fiscal impact, so were you not complying with the rules that were out there that you were paying for this coverage under the thought of the medical necessity when, in fact, in rule it was that we didn't cover those procedures?
Ms. Ringling or Mr. Iverson?
You're speaking specifically to the gastric bypass?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at more. You've got the breast reduction and some other things. I'm just questioning process here that you said it's not that it was excluded, but medical necessity, you were covering it. So to me, that's an oxymoron. It's covered, but we're doing it under medical necessity. I'm just trying to get it clear in my mind, because if it's now a covered service and there's no change in fiscal impact, that, you know, that has me raising questions.
Senator Hunhoff, I believe that was specific to the gastric bypass. The gastric bypass procedures were stated in a rule that they were not covered. However, when we would get those requests, we look at each one of those individually, and in some cases, they did meet all the criteria for medical necessity, so then we did pay for them.
Follow up, Senator Hunhoff?
Yes, thank you. Okay. So as we move forward then, have you transferred everything over and you're basing it on medical necessity? Although you still have, you know, I'm not clear if those excluded items and those other ones are, you know, does this set us up for something that if I make a request, well, yes, medical necessity, but it's not covered, but for somebody else, you know, just wondering how this is going to play out and what's been, you know, leading up to it.
Well, again, I think that we look at specifically gastric bypass cases, and you look at the comorbid conditions that are present. You look at the BMI of the individual, and we have now set some pretty specific criteria that is going to be out as policy for covering these particular procedures. I can understand your concern about setting up a precedent. We've had the medical necessity criteria and rule forever, and we do look at cases where something comes to us, and particularly for children, where the federal government says, even if you have guidelines that say you do not cover a particular service for a child, if it's medically necessary, you have to pay for it.
One last question. What's the difference between rule and policy?
I think what we've tried to strive for here is saying in the rule that we do cover a particular service, and then the policy is the guidelines that the individual has to meet in order for that to be covered.
Thank you.
Follow up, Senator Hunhoff.
No, thank you.
Are there other questions of committee members for these two presenters? I have a question, Mr. Iverson, on liver transplants. Now that we're going to cover adults on liver transplants, is there an age where an adult would not be able to receive a liver transplant?
I'm sorry, I had to look back at our medical consultant, and she indicates no, there would not be.
So a 90-year-old person could receive a liver transplant technically?
I'm going to call Dr. Mary Carpenter forward to answer your question.
Thank you.
The guidelines that are being
Would you please
at,
identify yourself?
So, excuse me. I'm Dr. Mary Carpenter. I do some medical consulting for the department. The guidelines that we're looking at using for liver transplants would not specifically put an age limit on, but medical criteria regarding health and benefit from the transplant would be what we would look at. So to say that you could have one at 64 but not at 65, that's not the case. But it has to do with underlying health and, like I said, medical benefit from that procedure.
Follow up on that, Dr. Carpenter. Are you using live donors or non-live donors for these liver transplants, or how do you distinguish?
That's not something that we have in guidelines at all. That would be up to the provider who is doing the service, and the service is provided at Medicare criteria centers of excellence, and so their physicians would make those decisions.
Are there any other questions of this proponent by members of the committee?
Senator Husted, with a question of Doug Decker. My question would be, I'm listening to the difference between policy and rule, and it seems to me that policy is talking about the guidelines that are used to cover something. How is this effective to us with respect to things that are laws, things that are rules, and things that are policy? If you could help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Decker?
Thank you for that question, and I don't know if I'll be able to articulate a distinction that makes much of a difference. Obviously, the legislature enacts the statutes which provide the overall guidance for the agency in promulgating their rules. Then the agency implements their rules to determine how the laws that the legislature enacts should be implemented. And then a step down from that is policy, which is more internal as to how the agency will implement the particular rule. And that's the hierarchy as to how things should occur. The difficult part becomes when you try to distinguish between rule and policy. You know, if it is internal for the management of the agency and it doesn't affect private rights or responsibilities as established by a statute, then it's appropriate for an agency to determine how it will do things by policy. If it is a private right or a right established by statute, then it probably should be something that's implemented by rule, because then you are establishing rights, duties, responsibilities, and obligations, and you want to avoid the possibility of arbitrary decisions based on criteria that may change without sufficient oversight. So that's how I view the hierarchy between policy, rule, and statute.
Follow up, Senator Husted.
Yes, thank you very much. That makes some sense to me, and I wondered quite honestly why we're going to do some transportation stuff here pretty soon, and why they don't have policy to move the speed limits out of town, another mile if some new business is built, rather than continuing to come back with rules, because they seem to be, the responsible parties have made these decisions, it's sometimes interesting to me why we are even involved in approving those rules. Anyway, it's just a discussion, and thank you for giving me the information that I asked for, Mr. Decker. Thank you.
Are there other proponents regarding these rules? Other proponents? Are there opponents who wish to testify against these rules? Opponents? Seeing none, we will close the hearing then to public testimony and move to committee discussion and or action. Are there further questions of the committee?
Madam Chair, this is Representative
Senator,
Hunt.
Representative Hunt.
I would just like to go back to Mr. Decker and his comments earlier. Mr. Decker, based upon your comments, when agencies use policy, vice rules, then the agency basically has greater control over what is going to be allowed and what is not going to be allowed. And I believe, as you said, that means less legislative oversight. Is that a correct understanding of your comments?
Mr. Decker?
Thank you, Chairman Gibson. Policy is the relationship of a rule to policy is a very difficult one in my mind, because policy obviously grants more discretionary decision making with an agency without the opportunity for direct oversight such as you would have when an agency promulgates a rule, because a rule needs to implement a statute. There needs to be underlying statutory authority which the legislature has granted to that agency. And so it gets to be a judgment call as to how the agency wants to implement the statutory direction that has been granted it by the legislature. Obviously, when a legislature passes statutes, it is implied within that statutory authority that the agency would implement the direction given it by the statute. The step for the legislative oversight would be then, do you direct the agency to implement this statute through rule by saying that in your grant of legislative authority? And then the next step down is, well, do we have to promulgate a rule here to implement the direction given us by the legislature? The way I try and resolve that in my own mind is when, like I said, there are private rights, duties, responsibilities, obligations imposed by the statute, and do you want to avoid arbitrary decision-making? If you have criteria within a rule and you meet that criteria for making your decision, then you're less likely to have an accusation of arbitrariness. So it is a difficult decision, I think, for agencies on how they choose to implement. Many times the legislature helps to solve that problem by saying promulgate a rule to determine criteria to make decisions.
Follow up, Representative Hunt. Are there further questions of the committee? Hearing none, the secretary will call the roll on this set of Department of Social Services rules. All those in favor will vote aye. All those opposed will vote no.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to move that we pass this set of rules.
Senator Hunstad has moved that we pass this set of DSS rules. Is there a second? Is there a second on this set of rules?
I'll second.
Senator Hunhoff has seconded this set of rules. All those in favor will vote aye. All those opposed will vote no. Secretary will call the roll, please.
Hunstad?
I'm sorry, aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunt?
No.
Gibson?
Aye. The motion is carried and the rules are approved, and I will pass the proverbial gavel on to Senator Hunstad for the next sets of rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gibson, Mrs. Senator Jim Hunstad. I'm in Aberdeen, South Dakota today at Northern State, and I have under mine several sets of rules, the first of which is the Department of Agriculture, the Animal Industry Board, to talk to us about amending disease control and meat inspection rules. Please come to the microphone, identify yourself for the public, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Hunstad. My name is Bendel Miller. I'm Assistant State Veterinarian for the state of South Dakota. under the Animal Industry Board. July 13th, the Animal Industry Board met to amend the rules that are currently operating, 1268-01 to 1268-28. These amendments were to change and update current dates of reference material to be consistent with the national animal health programs. I'll stand by for questions.
Are there any questions by any members of this committee? If you had enough opportunity to read through the rules and see what's happened, I believe, as was explained, this is mostly to meet updated information.
Senator Hunstad, I have a question.
You may have a question, as many follows as you need. Thank you. Proceed.
Sir, on Chapter 1268-20, Inhumane Treatment of Animals, I see that we are just updating those rules from 2007 to 2010. Could you explain to me the procedures for filing these complaints and investigation of these rules, investigation of reported violations? And just give me kind of a synopsis of this particular chapter.
Sure.
Thank you.
I'd be honored. Thank you. The procedure for inhumane complaint submission to our office is that anyone, private citizen, law enforcement, whoever observes something that they feel is inappropriate, calls our office. Our office, first of all, has authority over livestock species. Our office then sends field representatives out to the site to analyze the situation. This is a licensed veterinarian that works for our office and works for the state of South Dakota. They assess the situation and make a determination as to whether it's indeed animal neglect occurring, and then report back to our office for follow-up or further procedures as we deem necessary.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? I don't hear one from any other members, but I would have one. And this happens to us quite frequently in our discussion on rules, that something federal happens, there's a change federally, and so there's an updated manual, might update it from 1994 to 2003. I was wondering if your Animal Industry Board has any input into the fact that the federal government changes these references as they make a change from 1994 to 2003. What is your input procedure? Thank you.
To clarify, for my information, the board itself's input or input from the people that the board represents?
Your board represents us, I would guess, when the federal government is making changes. If they're changing what is perceived to be rough handling of animals, for example, if I bring a 4-H, if I bring a Cub Scout troop out to my farm and watch me dehorn cattle, they may think that's inhumane treatment. On the other hand, it's not. So if the federal government changes the rules about what is inhumane, do you, as an animal industry board, speak on our behalf in deciding what those new manuals are going to say? I guess that's what I was trying to figure out.
Sure. Thank you for that clarification. The Animal Industry Board certainly has input in through the federal rulemaking process, where they would, when they make those changes, they ask for public rule comments and things like that. The Animal Industry Board and the State Veterinarian's Office certainly has that input and passes that along.
Thank you for that information. Are there any further questions? If not, I would ask someone to make a motion to pass this set of rules.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question. Senator Valley?
Please proceed.
You said this when we were talking about the inhumane treatment of animals. You said it was only for livestock. So would that be, you know, we make that differentiation between livestock and pets, or where do we draw that line?
Our differentiation is by legal authority. We're tasked with livestock species. Pet species are left to the local authorities.
So livestock would be something that's would include those things that we raise for resell, for consumption. So does that include horses? I mean, I'm just trying to, what's the difference between raising horses and raising dogs, and I'm selling the dogs for sale, but not for consumption? And horses generally aren't sold for consumption. So I'm just trying to get where that, how do you draw that line?
Horses are specifically listed as livestock.
Okay.
The species are listed out in legislative, in our guidelines, I guess, in the law, as what we are, have the authority over.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? If not, I'm looking for a motion.
I so move that these rules be approved. Representative Gibson.
Senator Valley seconds.
I have a motion by Representative Gibson and a second by Senator Valley. I'm going to ask the Secretary to read the roll. Vote aye to pass this motion.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunhaus. Senator Hunhaus.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye. This motion was unanimously passed, and we'll move on now. Thank you very much, sir. We're going to move on to the first of three sets of rules by the Department of Revenue, this time dealing with insurance. And the first set of rules are about external review. If Mr. Moses would come to the mic, introduce himself, and explain to us why we're looking at rules about external review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Randy Moses, Division of Insurance. The genesis of these rules is federal legislation. When the federal government passed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, more popularly perhaps known as Obamacare, there were a number of different insurance provisions in that law, some of which became effective this year and are slated to become effective for plan years beginning on or after September 23rd of this year. One of those provisions deals with external review. What we were given the option in legislation of doing is adopting the NAIC Uniform External Review Model. And in fact, that's what you will see with these rules is that we are adopting that NAIC model with one exception. That is, we're adding rescission to the list of types of determinations that can be subject to an external review. That was based on some additional guidance we received from the federal agency, Health and Human Services. What we're talking about with external review is once a person has a claim denied, such as a claim denied for medical necessity or medical appropriateness, for example, there is in current law the allowance to go to the insurance company and make a appeal of that decision. Then that is reviewed internally within the company by someone other than made the original claim determination. These rules for external review allow that person now to appeal beyond the insurance company and go to an external review outside that insurance company. In fact, it would be with a independent review organization, or IRO as we are referred to them. That IRO would be a completely independent, could not have any affiliation with the insurance company in making these kind of determinations. In other words, there would be no conflict of interest. There are different time frames for when external reviews kick in, depending on the nature of the claim. For urgent care situations, the turnaround time is very, very quick. For other non-emergency situations, the time frames are different and a little bit longer. It also provides for appeals of external appeals of determinations that something is shouldn't be covered because it's experimental or investigational. And again, that outside independent review organization with that medical expertise would be utilized in that situation. The initial request is made to the via the Division of Insurance. The insurance company is then required to act upon that. The division would have final say so on whether or not the claim could be subject to external review. In other words, would it meet the guidelines set forth in these rules for external review? Once the external review decision is made, if it's made to reverse the decision, then the insurance company is required to immediately go ahead and get that claim reversed and paid accordingly. This does provide some significant additional protections for individuals for health insurance who have had their claims denied. And like I said, again, it's based upon what's specifically required under this federal legislation. I would stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Are there any questions by any members of this committee?
Mr. Chairman,
Please proceed.
Mr. Moses, I have just a comment, and I have to say here, I resent your sarcasm with labeling this Obamacare, and just wanted to say that perhaps this will protect some individuals in South Dakota from being denied claims. And for obvious reasons, we don't necessarily regard the insurance industry as being particularly ethical, and therefore I just don't care for your sarcasm in presenting this set of rules to the committee. Thank you.
If I may respond, Representative, it certainly wasn't intended in a sarcastic manner. I merely use that term since that's something that people generally recognize the legislation as. I don't believe the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is widely known, and that was simply my way of trying to make it more understandable to folks to know exactly what we're talking about, but certainly nothing untoward intended with the term used.
Mr. Chair?
Proceed.
Randy, just a question. There's a lot of letters that you received from plans, insurance companies. Did any of those recommendations or ideas they subjected, were they in the final product that you're producing here?
Yes, Senator, we did incorporate many of the comments. We tried to sort through them as best we could to make sure that, in fact, we are following the federal legislation and the NAIC model that the federal legislation refers to. And so, yes, we incorporate all those that made it closer to the model. They did catch a number of technical errors, and that's really what we're all about, trying to do is get this thing in the right shape and accepted all those that in fact accomplished that.
Just a follow-up, do you anticipate you're going to come back to us now after a year when this gets into place to tweak it and find out where some of the maybe areas we needed some changes?
At this point in time, Senator, I don't anticipate that we will. Since we began the rules process, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services did issue some regulations on this, and we think that the rules as proposed will and served on the committee will meet those new federal regulations as well as the original law itself, and therefore I don't anticipate in the absence of some new federal regulations to make any changes to this particular set of rules.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt.
Representative Hunt, proceed and continue with your follow-ups as necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Moses, I'm referring to a rule on page 41 of the package. It's a rule entitled Assignment of Independent Review Organization for Expedited Reviews.
And my question is, it indicates that the director can select an independent review organization to conduct this review. Is there a public record as to the identity of such approved independent review organization? And is the approval to be an independent organization, review organization, is that a decision made by the director? If you could answer those two questions, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Certainly. First of all, as far as the public access to who is approved IROs, yes, we do intend to make that a matter of public record. In fact, intend to post that on our website so that individuals will know who they are. The rules would require that it be a nationally recognized and certified organization. The director would be the one that would make the determination as to whether or not the organization that applied for certification in fact met the criteria for in these rules for certification of an independent review organization.
If I understand then correctly, any group that wants to be an IRO must submit their request to the director?
Yes, it would have to be submitted. That is correct, Representative.
And then who is the national accrediting or certifying group that would have to certify these IROs?
The rules do not specify groups. It has to be a nationally recognized group, but two come to mind. URAC and NCQA would be the two that would come to mind as far as our widely recognized national accreditation organizations.
Could you tell me what those two organizations are by full title?
Certainly. URAC is Utilization Review Accreditation Committee, and NCQA is a national. Oh, geez, I know that, and I can't. I'm sorry, I can't recall what the acronym stands for now off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. Is there anyone else that might have a question, Mr. Moses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lust.
Representative Lust, proceed and proceed with follow-ups as necessary.
Thank you. Mr. Moser, or Moses, I've got a question for you regarding what you just discussed with Representative Hunt. These IROs, is this all they do, or is it part of an accounting firm or a healthcare organization? Are they standalone? Could you explain what they are?
They could be part of a larger corporate entity. We have not had much familiarity with them here in South Dakota, and I don't believe any of them are actually have their corporation situs here in this state. So I don't have any direct knowledge of those organizations, but I do know that they're out there. We do have some lists of those organizations from other states, but as far as giving you a lot of detail on their exact structure, that I'm sorry, I really don't have that information.
Very good. And you kind of opened the door for the next question. This entire block of rules, is this a template that you receive from the federal government or another state?
The rules, going backwards a little bit, the federal legislation specifically mentioned the NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioner, model law on uniform external review as the standard that needs to be met. And so what you are seeing is, in fact, that NAIC model reduced into this administrative rule so as to meet the federal standards.
Okay, very good. And has this procedure, has this been used in other states prior to the federal legislation?
I don't recall the exact number of states that adopted this particular model. It's my understanding that somewhere in the neighborhood of three or five states have adopted this specific external review model. There was also a prior external review model that a number of other states had adopted. So in one version or another, there have been quite a number of states that have adopted it.
Has external review occurred in South Dakota prior to now?
No, this would be something new. To my knowledge, none of the current insurance companies offering plans are, well, I won't say I know for sure, 100% sure that all of them don't do it, but at least primarily they have not been doing it, so this would be a new procedure for most policyholders in South Dakota.
Thank you. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that has a question of Mr. Moses? I guess I would then end this with a comment that I think, as I look through this package today, I was fairly well impressed with the detail it went into. But when you informed me that this was something that came from the insurance industry to talk about this and their proposal. Then I also noticed all of the information that was sent back and forth to you from insurance carriers in the state, and I want to thank you for all the work you've done on this particular issue, because it looks like you put a lot of extensive work on it. Thank you very much, and I'm now looking for a motion. Hearing none, no, I need a motion.
This is Senator Hunoff. I'll move approval.
I have a motion by Senator Hunoff for approval. I need a second.
Representative Hunt, second.
I have a motion and a second. I'll have the secretary read the roll, and you may vote aye to pass this motion or nay if you're against it.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye. The motion was passed unanimously. We will now move on to the next one. This is also on insurance, and it deals with premium tax and genetic information, and it prohibits the insurance industry from using that information to discriminate against patients. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Joshua Anderson. I'm appearing on behalf of the South Dakota Division of Insurance. We have three basic groups of rules that appear here. The first one simply is to define annuity considerations returned. This rule simply will put into rule a definition that the Division of Insurance has been using for what we can confirm to be at least the past 30 years. The next two sets of rules that you'll see in here in 2006-39 is, just as you said, it prohibits genetic discrimination based upon genetic information in the individual market for insurance. And in 2006-40 is the same type of rules that prohibit discrimination based upon genetic information in the employer market. These are very similar in where they come from in their genesis to the last set of rules that Mr. Moses just got done speaking to. They are part of federal legislation that was passed, and the division is implementing them in order to give the state enforcement over these particular areas when it comes to discrimination based on genetic information.
So you would say, once again, that the wording here has mostly been taken from federal. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair. The wording that you see is in the put out by Congress. It's in the CFR. If you go there, you will find very substantially similar language. We have tweaked it, as you see in some of the comments that were sent in by the industry folks. We have made some changes to accommodate their concerns. There's also been a few changes that we've made to make these specific rules conform to the rest of the insurance rules that we've promulgated over the years, to try and keep things as similar as possible for interpretation standpoint.
I thank you for that explanation. Are there any members of this committee who have a question of Josh?
Mr. Chair, Senator Valley.
Senator Valley, please proceed and follow up as you need.
Again, there was a lot of back and forth comments. I'm going to go first on the annuity. I know the industry is not particularly I don't know what the word would be, excited about the tax on annuities, but did you incorporate the industry's concerns in your final draft here? And if you didn't, could you explain those that weren't?
The final draft that you have is identical to the original draft that took place. What we did receive from industry is that ACLI, if you look at their comment, you'll see that they disagree with the division's interpretation, and ultimately it just came down to a situation where we had to agree to disagree with them. There wasn't a lot of common ground. It was more a situation where they simply think that our interpretation is wrong, and we respectfully disagree.
Could you go into that disagreement a little bit so that I have an understanding of it?
Basically, what it boils down to is, in the division's mind, we will allow insurance companies to deduct annuity premiums that they receive during the 14-day look-back period. And during that time, consumers can return their product back to the company that they bought it from, and there's no penalty or anything else of that nature. Outside of that 14-day period, if a customer were to cash or surrender their annuity, early, we would still count that premium that they received towards their total overall premium tax for tax purposes. Versus if it's in the first 14 days that it's surrendered, then we allow them to deduct that back out, and they are not charged tax on that amount.
Thank you.
Any other member of this committee has a question? Once again, I'll say that I read also through many of the requests that people had for to talk to you, review this with you, and I see that you've done a lot of that. It's been extensive, and I appreciate your work on this issue as well. Are there now any further questions? Hearing none, I will ask someone to make a motion with respect to this set of rules.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we pass the rules as written.
I have a motion by Senator Valley to move this set of rules. Is there a second?
Representative Lust seconds.
I have a motion and a second. The second by Representative Lust. I'll ask the Secretary to read the roll and vote aye to pass the motion, nay to vote against the motion.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye. Once again, this motion was passed unanimously, and this set of rules has been approved. Thank you both very much. We are now going to move on to our final one through the Department of Revenue, this time with respect to business taxes and the Division of Motor Vehicles, which I believe deals with licensing for boats. And we're going to hear that same information repeated to us back later when we get to the Game, Fish, and Parks. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your explanations.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Richter. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Revenue and Regulation. I'm going to break this presentation down into two parts. First, I'm going to call a representative from business tax to discuss the business tax rules, and then I'll call a representative from the DMV to discuss the DMV rules. So at first, I'd call on Jan Talley to discuss the business tax rules.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jan Talley, Department of Revenue and Regulation. We're proposing these rules to be in compliance with streamlined sales tax. If you look at your packet and turn to page 6, The first rule is a sourcing rule for direct mail. What this does is it defines how direct mail services are taxed. On page 7 and 8 of our proposed rules, we define the terms used in direct mail. So there's definitions, and those, again, are definitions from streamlined sales tax. On page 8, then we go to sourcing rules for computer software maintenance contracts. What that rule does is define how those contracts will be taxed. On page 9, we have sourcing rules for software term license and subscriptions. And again, that defines how those type of transactions will be taxed. On page 10, we define terms for software maintenance contracts, licenses, and subscriptions. So those rules, that first set of rules, deal with sourcing of direct mail, sourcing of computer maintenance contracts, and software. On page 16, there's a rule that we're actually doing a correction on, and that reference in the rule was actually, we're changing it from consignor to consignee. That, as far as we can tell, has been wrong in that rule. So that's just simply a fix. And on page 17 is our last two rules, and those deal with passes to and memberships to fitness centers. These rules define that the municipal gross receipts and the tourism tax do not apply to those transactions. And that concludes my presentation. I'll stand by for questions.
Are there any members of the committee with a question for Ms. Talley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt.
Representative Hunt, proceed and continue with your follow-ups as necessary.
Ms. Halley, just a quick question. I don't really play golf very much. Is there a municipal sales tax of some sort that's applicable to to buying a round of golf fees, say, for example, at a municipal club or otherwise?
There are taxes that apply to memberships at golf courses, like the municipal tax would apply.
Could you then tell me what the difference between a fitness club and a golf course is?
With a fitness club is not specifically listed as far as an admission to an athletic event or cultural center. And with a golf course on the memberships, it would be the general rate versus the municipal rate.
I'm not sure I understood that, and I apologize, and maybe you could offer me some more explanation, but it seems to me if we're going to... You said the distinction was between a general tax, I guess, and a municipal gross receipts tax. I'm not sure I understand that. Maybe you could elaborate. I'm just wondering here why we're exempting out the fitness clubs. And whenever you take and target a particular group, I always have to ask some questions because many times there are other groups that are in a similar category, and I would just assume a golf course could be in that. So if you could elaborate a little bit further on that to help me as to why you're making that type of distinction, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to clarify. I'm checking here on the golf memberships and fees. The golf memberships would be taxed at the state rate, the general rate, if they were within a city, and the municipal gross receipts rate, because it is considered an admission to an athletic event, and it's something that we would tax under the municipal gross receipts. As far as the fitness centers, we have determined that, like, those passes or memberships to them do not qualify under that municipal gross receipts.
Thank you for that explanation, but I'm still a little bit surprised at how you can say that a golf course playing 18 holes is an athletic event any more than a membership at an athletic club, but maybe we'll have to discuss that another time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from any of the members of this committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lusk.
Representative Lusk, please proceed and follow as necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Talley, could you explain for me just the term sourcing and the significance of that term in the tax context?
Representative Les, sourcing is used to determine how a sale will be taxed. It defines where a sale is actually received. So within sourcing laws, when you're looking at a sales tax transaction, you look at where that sale is actually received. And within our regulations, we define general sourcing under a different regulation. And basically, the sourcing transactions start with a sale is sourced to where the actual sale is made. If it's not sourced there, it goes to the purchaser's location, and it could eventually end up at the purchaser's address if the seller has that in their records. So sourcing determines the receipt of a service or sale.
Very good. I appreciate that. Could you then explain just briefly how you source the direct mail and the software maintenance contract?
Okay, on direct mail, if you turn to page 6, towards the bottom there it talks about if the purchaser does not provide the seller with documentation of a direct pay permit, the transaction shall be sourced as following. And we talk about advertising and promotional direct mail. And it says upon receipt of the delivery information, the seller shall collect a tax according to the delivery information provided by the purchaser. So in that case, if the delivery information, for instance, if the direct mail was delivered to Peer, it would be sourced to there. Now, if the on this page 7 there, if the purchaser of advertising or promotional direct mail does not provide the seller with delivery information, the seller shall collect the tax according to subdivision 6406.01.63.5, which again goes back, that's our general sourcing rule, and that would go back to, it usually goes back to the customer location if the seller doesn't know anything else. If the seller cannot determine the delivery of the mail, it goes back to the customer location. And then the second section there is the seller again shall collect the tax according to the subdivision, which is the regular sourcing laws. And then as far as computer maintenance contracts, the sale of the computer maintenance contract shall be sourced. That's on page 8 there. The retail sale shall be sold by the seller with the sale of the software is sourced to the same address as the retail sale of the software. So if the software is delivered to Rapid City and you purchase a maintenance contract, it would be sourced to the Rapid City location. And the second section there is, says the retail sale of a computer software maintenance contract sold at retail, the renewal or the retail sale of that is treated separately from the retail sale of the software and shall be sourced in accordance with 6406.01.63, which again is our general sourcing laws, which a lot of times is sourced to the customer location. You go through a series, is it at the seller, does it go to the purchaser, and a lot of times it goes to the customer location. So if you purchased a computer software maintenance contract, it could be, and you purchased it maybe at a location in Rapid City, and then you purchased a renewal, and the seller of that software did not know the original purchase, and all they knew was the address of the customer, which might be Peer, they would source it to Peer. And this third section of there, again, talks about the retail sale of a renewal of computer software shall be sourced in accordance with the sourcing laws. So that again goes back to our general source. And sourcing of software term license and subscriptions, if the seller receives the information from the purchaser indicating the location has changed, a subsequent payment shall be sourced to that new location. So if the seller originally sold the software subscription to a Rapid City location and later found out that the renewal is going to a Peer location, they could source it to Peer. Again, this doesn't make any difference with the state sales tax, but it does make a difference with the municipal tax. And then the second section there. Oh.
No, I appreciate that explanation, and to cut to the quick, so most purchases, if they occur online, if I'm buying a software contract online, that's going to be sourced to my home address?
Representative Les, that's correct, because that's all they'll know, is your actual address.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Les. Are there anyone else with a further question?
Mr. Chair.
Ladies first.
Yes.
Thank you. This is Senator Hunoff. My apologies to the committee. I have talked to Representative Hunt. I need to exit to attend another meeting, so I will be getting off of the committee now.
Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. We'll be looking forward to meeting with you next time. Representative Gibson, did you have a question?
No, I'm fine.
Representative Hunt, did I hear you asking a question?
No, Senator Valley did, though.
Senator Valley, please proceed and follow as necessary.
Thank you. Just real quick, on page 6, that first paragraph looked like there might be a punctuation problem. I couldn't see where it ended. But my question regards the streamline. This is all being done to be in line with a streamlined sales tax. And could you just give a quick overview, because I get a lot of questions on this, where that streamlined sales tax is at, if you have that information. Thank you.
Senator Valley, we've been participating in streamlined sales tax since approximately the year 2000, and it's a group of states that are working together for uniformity in definitions and application of the tax, uniform rates, uniform definitions. And the goal of the streamlined sales tax is to eventually get Congress to pass a bill that would allow states to collect sales tax on internet sales. Now, a lot of the retailers have been working on that bill too, and of course their part in it is they're going to have to file the streamlined sales tax return. So they want uniformity in definitions and how you apply like sourcing of services and things like that. So, you know, with that in mind, with the definitions and things that are included in the streamlined sales tax, we need to pass rules that conform with the streamlined sales tax as far as like the sourcing of services and things like that.
And then it's my understanding that at this point our laws are in compliance with that streamlined sales tax initiative. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Oh, one other quick question. Credit card solicitations that would require an upfront fee, would that be, are those taxed?
I'm not sure. You mean a fee for getting a credit card or?
Yes.
I'm not sure really without checking on that. A lot of the fees, like the credit card processing fees, are exempt from sales tax, and a lot of their services are exempt from sales tax. But if they are providing any type of taxable service, we would apply sales tax to that. So I wouldn't be sure what your actual question is.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anyone else with a further question before I ask one? Hearing none, I will then ask if you can tell me, in the start of this discussion, you were talking about the changes that were made to computer maintenance agreements, software contracts, and direct mail. And in one of those discussions about direct mail, you handled advertising differently. Is that simply because we do not tax advertising in South Dakota? And if we don't, then why wouldn't it be exempted even if it was for the streamlined sales tax?
Senator Hunstead, with direct mail, a lot of times direct mail is defined. There is some advertising and promotional mail included within direct mail, and we do tax the service of direct mail, although it may include some advertising. And you are correct, advertising services that are prepared and placed in the media are exempt from sales tax. But this particular thing with direct mail is specifically taxed in our laws, even though it does include some advertising and promotional material.
So if I can understand this, then, is the direct mail costs, in other words, the cost of actually sending it out, not necessarily the advertising, is that fair?
With direct mail, if a direct mail person identifies the postage is actually exempt from sales tax.
Okay. That's what I was thinking, too. So the postage is not sales tax, and the advertising is not sales tax, so then I get lost again in the middle of asking... It doesn't seem to make any difference then if it's advertising or postage. How does it get taxed?
Direct mail, when you look at the definitions of what direct mail is, it's specifically defined as direct mail, which they said could include some advertising and promotional material. And that the cost of that direct mail service to the individual, you know, which could be... it could be printing cost. It could be preparing that advertisement. It's direct mail is not defined in our law as advertising. If it was advertising, if it was prepared and placed in the media, it would be exempt from sales tax. But the direct mail service is specifically taxed, which does include some of those advertising promotional materials.
Thank you very much. I know that there are many people in South Dakota that think, well, we've got sales tax. This must be the simplest thing in the world. You spend a dollar and you deduct 4 cents and call it sales tax. But it's obvious from your discussion today and our previous discussions that sales tax is not as simple as it seems. Is there anyone else that has a further question?
Senator Hunstead, I have a question.
Please proceed and follow as necessary.
Thank you. Ms. Talley, who actually pays? Do I pay, or does the software company pay this tax on the maintenance contracts and the subscriptions? So how do you actually collect it?
Representative Gibson, if that company was licensed in South Dakota to collect sales tax, and they were selling software or software subscriptions or software maintenance contracts, they would be responsible for collecting the tax. If they're simply an internet company that does not have nexus in South Dakota, the consumer would be liable for the use tax.
To follow that up then, are you able to collect that tax from the consumers when the company is not licensed in South Dakota realistically?
Representative Gibson, it's difficult to collect use tax from all of the individuals that purchase things over the internet. There is some difficulty in collecting that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? I would love to continue this discussion, but I think we're past this, and we have business taxes yet to talk about. The DMV taxes, and so we maybe should move on to that unless there's another question. Hearing none, please, Mr. Richter, bring on your spokesman for the DMV taxes.
Okay, we have Bonnie Gloat from the Division of Motor Vehicles to discuss the boat licensing rule.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The boat identification numbers rule has two amendments to it. The first one is increasing the number of digits in the boat ID number, the South Dakota boat ID number that's displayed on the outside of the boat, from three to four numbers. And we did this to automatically assign the number when a new boat enters South Dakota for title and registration, to do it automatically with our computerized system, and to ensure that we don't duplicate any of the existing three-digit numbers. The second thing that this amendment addresses is to clean up the reference to the three-year validation decals for licensing to comply with the legislation just passed this last session.
Well, thank you for that explanation. Is there anyone that has any questions with respect to the DMV changes? I am sure we're going to hear more about this as we get into the game fish and parks later, because they have rules that affect this as well. Hearing no questions, I thank you very much for your testimony, and we passed the law, so I guess we knew what we had in mind when we set us on this path. Is there anyone else there that is a proponent of these rules?
No one that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Are there any opponents? Any opponents? Hearing none, and I'm sorry I haven't done that in the past, but usually I guess I hope someone will speak up. I am now looking for a motion due pass on this set of revenue, business tax, and DMV taxes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gibson, I move due pass.
Thank you, Representative Gibson. I have a motion from her. Is there a second? Representative Behe, is it true I heard you second it? Valley?
Senator Valley, I'll second. I want to make sure before I do, though, are we... Which set? Are we doing all of them at once? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, they're all part of one set of rules. They just had two different people explaining them. Jan Talley did the taxes, and Bonnie did the ones on the DMV.
Okay.
But it's the same. It's in the same package, sir.
I will second.
Thank you for that second. I'll ask Secretary to read the roll. Vote aye to pass this motion.
Gibson?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunt?
No.
Hunstead?
Aye. We have this package passed, and we're going to move on to the last one that I'm responsible for today, and this is the Department of Transportation. They're going to change, or proposing to change, a rule in Lawrence County that affects a small section of US 85. If you would introduce yourself to the listening audience and us and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Nevin with the Department of Transportation. I do have for the committee's consideration this morning one speed zone rule in Lawrence County, and it's actually on Highway 14A. This amendment would amend 70010209 to extend a 45-mile-an-hour zone that begins at the intersection of Highways 14A and 85 at the north end of Deadwood. And for further clarification for some of you folks, Highway 85 would be Boulder Canyon going down from Deadwood towards Sturgis. Highway 14A would be the highway going up the hill towards Spearfish. Currently, beginning at that intersection, a 45-mile-an-hour zone exists for about a quarter of a mile up the hill on Highway 14A towards Spearfish. Now, at the top of the hill, approximately 1 mile from the intersection, the Lodge at Deadwood, a hotel, casino, restaurant, convention center facility, has been developed and is now open. This facility will be a significant traffic generator. This amendment to the rule will extend that 45-mile-an-hour zone from that intersection all the way up the hill past the lodge in order to slow traffic down a little bit as it's going by where cars are entering and leaving the highway at the intersection with the lodge at Deadwood. Currently, it's a 55-mile-an-hour zone there. So this would extend that 45-mile-an-hour zone all the way up the hill till just past the turnoff to the lodge. As an additional traffic safety measure, a left turn lane on Highway 14A at the entrance to the lodge has also been constructed. This speed zone rule was initiated by the local officials and has the concurrence of all those local officials and law enforcement. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand by for any questions.
Are there any members of this committee that have any questions of Mr. Nevin?
Mr. Chairman, I have a comment.
Please continue.
Mr. Nevin, I was just out to Deadwood over the weekend for Cool Deadwood Nights and drove that particular road and see the necessity for the speed law change, especially when the hills are brimming with lots of people. So I think that's a very good idea to slow traffic down as much as possible to prohibit accidents in that area.
Thank you. That's certainly the hope.
Are there any further questions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Valley.
Senator Valley.
Just a quick question, Mr. Nevin. When you change the speed limits and then it comes from the request of, let's say, the city council or whatever, is there and I know it probably it goes through the commission, but is there a public hearing held in any way on that other than, you know, the city council talking about it? Is there a notice given that this is on the agenda of, let's say, the transportation commission? Or how is John Q. Public know about this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Valley, when a proposed speed zone rule comes from the general public, there may or there may not be some local meeting held by the government body to consider that. Once it's come to the department and the rule is proposed, there is, as you have alluded to, through the rule promulgation process, a hearing that is placed on the Transportation Commission's agenda and notice published in the newspaper to give the public an opportunity to be heard at the time the Commission is considering whether or not to adopt that amended speed zone rule.
Oh, just in a follow-up, so it does say what it's for. I mean, I see in the paper that there is a Transportation Commission meeting, but it doesn't say all the things that are on the agenda. But if you are changing a rule, it will say the speed limit change from intersection or whatever. Am I correct that notification is in there then?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator O'Malley. Is there any further questions? I will then do mine. It does mention that there will be a $300 cost for two new signs. I would assume if we picked up the sign at the 0.25-mile location and moved it down the road 3/4 of a mile, we should be able to use that same sign. Why do we see new signs?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to refer that to the maintenance personnel that are actually in charge of putting up and replacing signs. My thought was as well, we've got a sign currently that says the 55-mile-an-hour zone begins 1/4 mile north of that intersection, and we could, the result of this rule change will be to remove that sign and to erect a similar sign at the north end now of the extended 45-mile-an-hour zone. Why it references the new sign, I'm unable to tell you, but I would be happy to try to find that information and give it to you.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, I always ask that kind of a stupid question every time, but so you should start to expect it, I guess. Thank you very much. Are there any further questions? Hearing none, are there any further proponents? Are there any opponents? Any opponents? Seeing none, do we have a motion from the committee?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, I so move.
I'll second. I have a motion from Representative Hunt and a second from Representative Gibson to pass this set of rules moving the signs, the speed limit signs in Lawrence County. Madam Secretary, would you read the roll?
Yes.
Gibson?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Hunstead?
Aye. This set of rules has been passed, and I'm passing the gavel to Representative Lust. Thank you.
Representative Lust, Representative Lust, this is Doug in here. Before we proceed to our next set of rules, staff needs a break for about 5 minutes.
Oh, very good. Let's take a 10-minute break. We'll be here at 5 till.
Thank you.
Reconvene at 5 till.
Representative Lust, with the Board of Regents is here to make their presentation. Staff is here, so I think we can get going again.
Can I get a nose count of everyone who's back from our break? Senator Valley, Representative Hunt, and Representative Gibson, and Senator Hunstead.
I'm back.
Hunt's back.
Here.
All right. Looks like everybody's here. With that, we will entertain some proposed rule changes to the South Dakota Opportunity Scholarship Program. Would a representative from the Board of Regents please come forward and pitch those rules?
Representative Lust, members of the committee, my name is Paul Terman. I'm with the South Dakota Board of Regents, oversee the Opportunity Scholarship Program. This last legislative session, there were a number of changes to the statute itself, primarily as it impacted the credit hour requirements. The Board of Regents had a public hearing on August 12th in which they reviewed the proposed changes to the rules. No written comments or verbal comments were made at that time, and I present these to you here this morning. The primary changes, I think, reflect the what used to be the 15 credit hour requirement. Now that has become a set of different thresholds, and I think it drives with the intent behind the initial statute that students hopefully progress at a rate that they are able to complete their college careers within 4 years. The new thresholds are consistent with that 15, 15, 15 as they moved along, and now they need to meet 30, 60, 90 by the different time periods within the program itself, maintain the 30 credit or the GPA requirements and the continuous enrollment. And you'll find that there were a number of places throughout the administrative rules that reflected that credit hour requirement, and we've made those changes throughout. One other, I think, minor changes that have come as a result of just kind of ongoing discussions and interaction with students and parents and administrators on campuses. Section 3, I think a few years ago, you'll find that the legislature had changed the statute to allow a student to leave and then return if they did that within 2 years. The statute and the administrative rule was quite specific, 2 years from the point of high school graduation, and for the longest time we'd had to be consistent with that particular point in time, so high school graduation date. But if a student had returned but then didn't enroll until the fall, 2 years after graduation, they would be ineligible. And we've tried to clean up the language to kind of specify that a student, I think the intent behind the statute itself was to allow those students to come back in. I think the only other place is that we've completely eliminated the requirement for the CAP exam, which was a proficiency exam requirement that had been put in place. The legislature this last year repealed that particular piece of the statute. We've addressed that in the administrative rules to be consistent with the fact that no student in the program had ever failed that exam, and it became more of a burden on the private institutes and the technical institutes that were involved in the program. I'll answer any questions that the committee might have as it relates to the proposed rule changes that are in front of you.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, can you tell me if there are going to be any other proponents of these rules testifying?
Not to my understanding.
Okay, very good. Well, while we have you there, do any members of the committee have questions of Mr. Terman?
Mr. Chairman, I just have one on the first change that I see. It changes the word course load to credit hour threshold, and I was wondering if credit hour threshold was defined anywhere.
Senator Hunt, Mr. Chairman, no, it is not, but you'll find that within the statute section where we do address threshold, those are spelled out to represent the 30, 60, 90, which are then consistent with third term, fifth term, and then seventh term within the program. And it allows a little bit of flexibility for students who might start in the spring, which is somewhat common, about 30 to 25 students every year will start in the spring, and it gives them that flexibility to enter in just as if they had entered in right after high school graduation. Military students and students who just study abroad typically fall into that category.
Very good. Senator Hunstead, any further follow-up?
No, thank you. I got it.
Representative Lust, I have a question, please.
Please proceed, Representative Gibson.
Thank you. Mr. Terman, I've just been talking to some parents over the weekend who have students currently in our South Dakota colleges, and they were complaining about this very issue of not being able to graduate within the 4 years that they have set aside for college, because not only with the credit hours situation, but also with courses that they need for graduation requirements that aren't offered in certain semesters. Is this problem addressed anywhere in your discussions along with these credit hour thresholds?
Representative Gibson, I believe that overall the changes that have been made to the credit hour structure addresses those concerns. In the past, a student who would have run into that particular situation would have either had to forego the scholarship, or they would have had to send an exemption request to the executive director, and then we would have to confirm with the campus and try to validate whether or not an exemption or a waiver would be awarded. And so a student who would typically, if they're waiting specifically at the end of their fourth year in the program and had to stick around and then continue on, they, because they'd already probably met the 90 credit hour threshold, that would allow them to at least receive the full funding that's awarded, at least within the program itself.
Further questions of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, I have a couple of questions.
Have at it, Representative Hunt.
First of all, just a quick typo that you'd probably catch, but on page 4, in the second full paragraph, I think you struck over the word T-O, and I think that was an error. I think you want that T-O. That would be in the paragraph that's been renumbered, parentheses 1, close parentheses, and then it says, a student who fails. I think you want to keep in that T-O to make your sentence understandable. At least on the draft that I have. You may have a later draft. Secondly, I would direct your attention to page 2, and in about the center of that page where we're talking about the 2 years, in essence, being granted students who leave the state and then come back to the state. Let me have your thoughts. I thought that last year, maybe it was the year before, that legislation was introduced to accomplish the same purpose, and that legislation passed the House but failed in the Senate. And I'm wondering, are we trying to do by rule what we couldn't get done by legislature? Unfortunately, I didn't have time to take a look and go back into the legislative history, but I assume you may know of the proposed legislation that I'm referring to. And then the other point is, I'm wondering about this two-year rule to begin with. A student, basically, who stays here in the state and goes on to college, university in the state, doesn't in essence get 2 years to decide what they're going to do. And in fact is, when a student leaves the state, goes to another school, and then has his 2 years to come back in, they're actually going to take a spot away from somebody who is staying here in the state and didn't go out to some other state outside South Dakota. It seems to me that as far as the merits are concerned, we're certainly favoring somebody that decided they didn't want to have anything to do with South Dakota, at least initially, and then when they changed their mind, they came back in and take a spot away from some student who wanted to go stay here in the state. I'd appreciate your comments. One, do you recall the legislation I'm referring to that was defeated in the Senate? And secondly, what do you have to say about the merits of the argument that I just presented? Your comments would be appreciated.
Okay. Representative Hunt, on the first issue, I do recall, and that was actually the proposed bill that had come forward was something that the Board of Regents had actually denied a waiver that had come through. And there are two distinctions. I think the first is what's in the statute speaks specifically to a student who, right out of high school, has gone and attended a post-secondary institution outside of the state, and they have that two-year window of being able to come back. The legislation that was introduced 2 years ago was that a student who had started out in South Dakota and then had left and then came back and wanted to then be able to continue on with the receiving the scholarship funds. And the waiver that we had reviewed, we basically looked at the statute and the administrative rules and felt that that was not really what the intent of the legislature had proposed when they implemented that particular feature of the statute. And so we denied the request. The student worked with his representative, and as a result, the legislation came forward. And so it's continued to this change to the administrative rule still would not allow that particular feature to occur. Only if you started someplace else can you eventually come back into the system. If you start here and then leave, this particular change does not help address that particular concern. As it relates to the statute, I think initially there in 2004 when the legislature had implemented the Opportunity Scholarship, this feature was not available, that you needed to come straight out of high school and attend one of our institutions. I think what occurred after that, and I believe it was 2 years after the fact when in 2006 when this was put in place to allow this a little bit flexibility, and that students oftentimes made some poor choices, that they would attend someplace, realize within the first semester that eventually they would like to return. And some of those students were eventually being kind of discouraged. They took the curriculum, they met all the requirements, and as in the end, they were not able to receive the scholarship. And I think the legislature saw fit to allow a student to make that decision with the idea that hopefully we would encourage them to return to South Dakota. The majority of the students that come back and are eligible under the statute normally only stay away for a semester. And so the most common ones, I think about 25 a year, University of Nebraska, Lincoln, University of Minnesota are the two that steal a lot of our students, and eventually I think we've been able to track them back. And this feature has helped to be one of those strong factors that helps return them to South Dakota. Hopefully they'll stay as well. So hopefully those addressed your two concerns.
Just a follow-up, though. Would you not agree that, in essence, we're penalizing the potential students who are going to stay here in South Dakota? Because they're losing a spot in the drawing, if you would, here, and that preferential treatment is being given to someone who obviously didn't have the same type of commitment to the state of South Dakota for the... That's one of the reasons why we have this Opportunity Scholarship. It seems like there's an inequity here that isn't necessarily being addressed. Could you comment further, please?
Yep. Representative Hunt, I would agree if the statute was set up and the scholarship program was set up in a way that kind of identified slots. Right now, a student who meets all six of the requirements for initial eligibility automatically are enrolled in the program. And so, if we, for instance, we have about 1,200 students who will come straight out of our high schools this last year and will become eligible in the program, they're automatically given slots. And if we have 25 who come back after having left, they also are given the slot. I think the bigger concern is, at what point does the legislature start to say that because we've allowed a little bit more and more flexibility in the program, does that increase the cost of the general fund? But right now, no student who makes a choice to go right into the program is ever losing out because a student from outside of the state eventually comes back. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. Further questions of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Valley.
A couple questions. First one is, if a student goes to summer school in another state, would that disqualify him? If I go to some place and take a summer course, and I'm obviously just gone for the summer, which is that counted as a semester away from school?
Senator Valley, the continuous enrollment requirements are driven specifically toward the fall and spring semester. So you need to be enrolled in the fall and spring semester under the old and the new credit hour requirement. And in the past and in the future, students who had taken courses through either exchange program, which is very common, or if they just picked up a course close to them via the internet, they would still get to count those credits, and it would not adversely affect them.
Okay, thank you. When does a student receive the payment? Because I noticed on, forget what page it was, but we started talking about, I think it was page 3, where we talk about when the start of the semester falls. When do you qualify and actually get the money?
Senator Valley, there are a couple different deadlines that students have to meet. The application deadlines are always set for September 1st and then January 15th. So students have to have their materials to the admission personnel at the campuses by that time. Then the campuses go through and determine whether or not they're initially eligible. And then the payments, or at least their funding request roster, is due to us on October 1st. We then distribute the funds by October 15th. The majority of the campuses basically can early on, before tuition bills and everything come due, can identify whether or not a student is going to be eligible, and they normally simply just subtract that from their bill. So it, on their statement, it'll say SDOS minus 500, so they're not asked to pay that tuition or the fee cost, assuming that eventually the state will reimburse the institution for those students. I think there are one or two institutions that will cut a check out to a student after the October 15th time period for which we provide the funding to the campuses. So there is a little bit of a lag there, but the time is still, I think, needed to make sure that anytime we have cases where here's a student whose initial eligibility is maybe in question and we need to sort through the issues that are occurring, that window has been in place to make sure that we can accommodate those situations.
I guess my question stems from, how do you know that they're going to complete those 15 or 30 hours if we've already given the money out?
Under the old, the previous statute required that the campuses had to confirm that they're attempting 15 hours. And so if they were not enrolled in 15 credit hours, then they could not be submitted for their funding request. I think the new statute allows a little bit broader kind of flexibility, but if a student attempts 12, then we can provide them with funding under the idea that before they're ever going to meet the next set of thresholds, they need to be making up those credit hours someplace along the lines. And so it opens a little bit more of a window of allowing the students the ability to meet kind of the unique natures of their degree requirements without such a real rigid structure for 15-15 as they progress through. But if they don't complete the credit hours in the past, they would have still received the $500 or the $1,000 under the old model. This just simply kind of broadens it a little bit.
So in other words, I could still get my money. I mean, do I ever have to refund it if I don't complete the courses? How does that work?
No, Senator Valley, we've never had a process in place that has required. So if they're meeting the eligibility or the continuing eligibility criteria at the October 1st date, then they will receive the funding, which normally is basically given straight to the campus. There's no opportunity for a student simply to pull the money. That those funds have gone toward tuition and fees specifically. But we have never had a refund process under the old or the current set of administrative rules.
On page 8, why do they, the synchronous distant education courses not count? Could you discuss that? And tell me what they are. I don't even know what they are.
Senator DeValle, those would be situations where a student is involved in a distance course which never really meets face-to-face. Oftentimes, synchronized would be kind of the correspondence course. In the past, we'd put some specificity as it relates to that those sets of courses just to demonstrate on how they would count, to make it clear to a campus that they could count those toward the 15 credit hour requirement. Now, as long as the student has earned credit from those activities, it counts under the new threshold, so that particular piece was not required to put in there any longer.
Okay.
That good, Senator Valley?
That does it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions of the committee? Hearing none, Mr. Terman, I have a couple questions for you. If you could look at page, I guess the second page of the rules, 2440.1303. If you look at the second full sentence, it indicates that full-time enrollment in a distance education program and so on and so forth. How is part-time enrollment in a distance education program, what impact does that have, if any?
Representative Lust, under the new requirements, it would allow a student to start out part-time, but then in a second semester, they have to make that up. But the majority of the students in the program are full-time students. And I think if they take part outside in a part-time, it would start their clock. And so if they ever decided to move back or begin to participate at one of the 16 participating institutions, they would then need to be able to be in compliance with the 30 credit hour requirements.
So if they're full, if they're part-time, they're not considered attending outside of the state?
I'm sorry, Representative. If they are outside of the state, and not enrolled in the program, if they take at least 3 credits, if they start a post-secondary institution, we typically see that as, all right, you have started your post-secondary career, and once you attempt to return back, then you would have to still be in compliance with the same set of timelines as if you were enrolled in the program, say the fall 2010. I decided I was just going to take 3 credits outside of the state or via a distance program and no other courses, but then I wanted to start fresh in the program in spring 2010. Under the way that we've always looked at it, those students would basically be considered, all right, you would be a second term individual in the program. You'd have lost out on the $500 that you could have gotten that first semester as we move forward. So you're only eligible for, I think, $4,500 for the total program. And then you need to be able to hit 30 credit hours by the time you start your third term of post-secondary education.
Is that what that second sentence says?
I would say it doesn't have that level of detail. No, Representative Hunt.
Well, my concern there is that you've indicated that if you're full-time enrollment in a distance education program, that does constitute attendance outside South Dakota. But in your example, where you use taking 3 credits online distance learning, that would not constitute attending outside South Dakota. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I think our attempt to strike what was listed right below that was to address exactly what you're describing. And I think in hindsight, possibly striking that first section would probably be a way, or that the sentence you're describing would also help ensure that the part-time is something that's not necessarily, it would still count toward the enrollment pattern for the Opportunity Scholarship process.
Okay, you might want to take a look at that, because I don't think it accomplishes what you desire. If you could also look at page 4 of the rules, on the paragraph referenced earlier by Representative Hunt, on subparagraph 1, the last sentence is an addition, it's underscored, and it indicates a persistence waiver may be granted by the executive director, thereby being discretionary. Why is it not mandatory?
Representative Lust, the persistence waivers are granted in situations where, and I think that probably the two most common that we have are military deployment and medical hardship. And so if a student or in study abroad, so students who have gone overseas or taken a part in a sponsored program, if a student has gone through and because of their activity in one of those situations is not going to be able to meet the threshold, then we grant them a persistence waiver in which they don't receive funding until they are able to come full cycle with the program. So, for instance, we have a number of situations going on right now where a student in the past has received a medical hardship to not meet the 15-credit-hour requirements. So if they only start their third semester in college and they only have 21 credits because of that, we will grant them a persistence waiver with documentation from a medical practitioner that says for the fall 2010 semester you will not receive funding. You will be able to get funding in the fall or the spring 2010 semester as long as you now hit that threshold. So they have basically one semester of a persistence kind of put things on hold until they meet the requirements.
Well, so my particular question for you is, in that particular rule, we're talking about active military service.
Yes.
If someone does not meet the credit hour threshold requirement because of active military service, why should the persistence waiver be discretionary, not mandatory?
Oh, I see what you're saying. In essence, I think we asked for at least a waiver to be put in place or to be requested on behalf of the student, just so we have the documentation we can communicate those things to the scholarship officers at the campuses. We've never turned down a waiver request from military personnel.
Okay. Again, I think you may want to look at that, because I think if they do have active military service, then that's the reason they're not meeting the threshold in my mind. The persistence waiver should be granted automatically, but...
And that'd be changing
anyway,
that from... Sorry.
From maybe to shall.
Okay.
Any further questions by the members of the committee? Hearing none. Mr. Chairman, can you tell me, are there any opponents?
Not that I'm aware of, Senator Lust.
Okay. Assuming there's no opponents, we will close the committee hearing to proponent and opponent testimony and open it up to discussion and or action.
Move do pass.
Senator Hunstead moves do pass. Is there a second?
Senator Valley seconds.
Seconded by Senator Valley. All those in favor of passage of these rules, in favor of that motion, will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary, please call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye. I'm sorry, my button didn't work.
Hunstead.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye. With that, the rules pass, and I will defer to my colleague in Mitchell to take the rest of the agenda.
Thank you, Representative Lust. Question to staff. It said 12:15 on my log here. I'm assuming, though, that we're still on because I'm still seeing everybody here. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. We'll move along here. This is the last rule that we're hearing. It's from the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks, and it's regarding the three-year license option being eliminated that we discussed earlier in the Department of Revenue, and also the changes in the rules for the ducks and geese this fall. And when you're at that, Mr. Life, if you would tell me a little bit about the Central Flyway Council. I'm sure you probably told me about it before, but I'm not exactly sure. I think that's a group from Canada and us in Mexico, but I can't quite remember exactly what precedent they have over ruling on how we set our limits. Thank you.
We'll do, Senator Valley, when we get to that. What we have for you is a rather short list of rule adoptions that the Game, Fish, and Parks Commission adopted at their meeting in earlier this month up in Aberdeen. Those rules, again, pertain to boat licensing and to waterfowl hunting seasons. I have with me this morning, or this afternoon, I guess it is now for those of you East River, Bob Snyder, who's the Assistant Director in our Parks Division, to offer a brief explanation of the boat licensing rule changes, and then I will address both your question, Senator Valley, and a brief presentation of the changes to the waterfowl hunting regulations.
Thank you, Senator Valley, and members of the committee. Staff with the Department of Revenue and Regulations spoke very briefly about the boat license changes, and I'm going to give just a real brief background that I think will be helpful. The 2010 legislature amended the boat license law, SDCL 32-3A5.1, to eliminate the requirement that boat licenses expire on December 31st of the terminal year of the period issued. This change in statute was made to allow owners to purchase their boat licenses at the same time that they purchased their trailer licenses and other vehicle licenses. Second step is that the Division of Motor Vehicles is now capable of accepting applications for vehicle and trailer licenses online. They can't do that currently for boat licenses because of the three-year option period for boat licenses that's available. Working together with the Department of Revenue and Regulations, we've proposed this change in the rules that would eliminate the three-year boat licensing option, leaving the current one-year license option available, and thereby making it possible to renew your boat licenses online in sync at the same time with your trailer license that the boat sits on and all of your other vehicles.
Senator Valley, if it's your pleasure, I'll go ahead and handle the waterfowl hunting regulations. I can't recall if I introduced myself. If I failed to do that, Tony Life, Director of the Wildlife Division. You'll notice in the public notice that there was a reference made to both the Central Flyway Council and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The reality is that the Central Flyway Council really is a quasi-government agency, really has no rulemaking or any authority over laws or rules. It is a coalition of states and provinces. Each state or province has a member that represents that state or province on this council. And what the council's responsibility is to formulate regulations pertaining to waterfowl hunting seasons that are then forwarded on to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who ultimately has management authority. It's up to the states then to create rules and regulations that conform with the authority that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has and the rules that they adopt through their Federal Register pertaining to migratory bird hunting. for South Dakota, I serve as the representative or the council member for the Central Flyway Council myself, so I have some direct knowledge of that process and how that went through. This year, the Central Flyway Council made two recommendations to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for adjustments to the daily limits for both both ducks and Canada geese. One of those recommendations was to change the pintail limit from 1 to 2 within the bag limit, and accompanying with that would change the possession limit from 2 to 4. That rule or that that change was approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Game Fish and Parks Commission did take subsequent action to adopt that change within the administrative rules of South Dakota. The other change that the Central Flyway Council recommended was that states be allowed to harvest 4 Canada geese instead of 3. This is during the regular Canada goose hunting season that happens, that starts on October 1st. And along with that would be an increase in the possession limit. The Fish and Wildlife Service did not approve that requested change because of the potential impact it could have on some migrating Canada geese that were coming through. We have explained to the service that we have a substantial problem in South Dakota pertaining to Canada geese and the damage that they can cause to crops. In response to that, an earlier recommendation from the Central Flyway Council was adopted by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and that was to increase the early fall Canada goose hunting season, which happens during the month of September, increased the bag limit during that season from 5 to 8. That change was approved by the Fish and Wildlife Service, adopted by the Commission, and approved by this committee at an earlier meeting. So we are able to target those resident Canada geese a little bit better with the increase in the bag limit during September, but we're not able to get the Fish and Wildlife Service to go along with an increase in the bag limit during the regular Canada goose hunting season that starts in October and runs through the end of the year and even into January here in South Dakota. With that, Mr. Snyder and I would certainly stand by for any questions that the committee might have, Senator.
Thank you. First of all, I'm going to go back to the boat license and ask if there are any questions by the committee on that aspect. If there are none, we'll move on to Mr. Life's presentation on the pintail increase. We doubled the number there. Is there any questions on that?
Hi, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lust.
Go ahead.
Tony, I've been reading Ducks Unlimited for years, and it's always, there seems to be an article almost every issue about the plight of the pintail. Has that significantly turned around?
Representative Lust, yes. Things certainly have improved when it comes to pintail populations. They are over population objectives right now, and that's primarily linked to habitat conditions. Pintails breed in a short grass prairie, some of the lighter habitat, less than what you would actually think a duck of that size would nest in. South Dakota is a key part of that production. The good wetland conditions that we have in central South Dakota on into central North Dakota have contributed to an increase in pintail numbers, and they have turned a corner and are in a much better place situation population-wise than they were just a few years ago.
Very good. Thank you.
Further questions by the committee? If there are no further questions for these gentlemen, are there any other proponents in any of the locations? Any further proponents? If there are no further proponents, are there any opponents at any of the locations? Any opponent testimony? Last call. If there's no opponent testimony, and if there are no further questions, we'll close the committee action to and now open it up for or close it to public testimony and open it up to committee action and or discussion.
Representative Lust moves to pass.
Mr. Chairman, I second. Representative Gibson.
It's been moved by Representative Lust and seconded by Representative Gibson to pass the rules as written. All those, is there any discussion? If there is no discussion, the Secretary will call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The Secretary will call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunstead.
Aye.
Blust.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye. The ayes, we've received a sufficient number of ayes to pass the rules, so they will be approved as written. And that will conclude the my section of the program, and I turn it back to Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Senator. Thanks to all of you. You did a good job again today. I think we should probably follow Senator Hunstead's announcement when he recognizes a particular member. He says in so many words, just go ahead and keep asking your questions until you're finished. That probably will save a little time as far as constantly going back and forth to the chair. We'll just remember that for next time. The last item on our agenda before we entertain a motion to adjourn is some proposed legislation. I hope that you have a copy of the proposed legislation that Mr. Decker sent out. This is basically dealing with South Dakota Codified Law 1-26-4.7, and in particular, the statute that was passed last session and the session before, which basically required the Interim Rule Review Committee to consider whether any rule complied with 615-1, and that's the unfunded mandate rule. Mr. Decker and I have had some dialogue back and forth, and what you have in front of you is, in essence, the last draft that we kind of worked together. You'll notice that what we have done in the proposed draft is to say that the Interim Rules Committee can cause an agency to revert back to a prior step or hold public meetings in addition to those already held whenever, according to subparagraph 9 on page 2, the proposed rule may impose unreasonable costs on a county, municipality, or school district when the county, municipality, or school district may not have sufficient funding to perform the activity required by the proposed rule. As I view it, this amendment to 126-4.7 simply gives us another ground, namely an unfunded mandate ground, to cause a reversion of the agency's process in introducing the rule. And kind of takes away from us having to try to figure out what sort of a process we're going to have or we're going to adopt in order to ensure that any rule complies with 615-1. In my opinion, this may make it a little cleaner and neater, but I certainly want all the members of the committee to have an input, and so that we're going to provide you with that opportunity now. If we have to go back for redrafting, we, of course, will do that. But your comments would be appreciated at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the work that you and Doug Decker has done on this. I think that this is very clean and says exactly what I think was maybe trying to be attempted before, and yet does it in a cleaner way. So I thank you for your work on that, and I certainly support this this proposed legislation. We'll be glad to work with it.
Thank you, Senator. Further comments?
Senator Valley.
Chairman Hunt, I agree. Okay, sorry.
Go ahead. Representative Gibson, go
Chairman.
Ahead, and then Senator Valley.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Hunt. I also agree with Senator Hunstead that this certainly cleans up the law for the Rules Committee, and I thank you for your work, and I will certainly support this in the next legislative session.
Thank you. Senator Valley.
Yeah, my question is two of them. One is unreasonable, and is, I suppose that's how we determine that as a committee, is that it wouldn't be any cost, but it would be unreasonable. And I guess that's going to be, we would take a vote on whether we feel it's unreasonable. Would that be the manner we handle that?
Senator, yes, I believe, you know, for example, you could have a $500 cost to a community. That would be an unfunded mandate, but maybe $500 under all the circumstances really isn't that much of a problem. So, yes, the word unreasonable is to give us a little more discretion to deal with those type of situations, but that's a good question. Other comments?
I like what you've done. I think it gives us flexibility, and I think it more accurately portrays how this process works than the former language.
Thank you, Representative Lust. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, my second one is, do we need to include townships in this? We got counties, municipalities, or school districts. Do we need to include townships? I'm thinking of things like roads.
Pardon? Senator, I think that we'll have Mr. Decker comment. I would think that township funding typically comes via the county, and that might cover it there. But Mr. Decker, your comments, please.
Mr. Chairman, this is Doug. I use those three specific units of local government because that is the language from the 615-1 unfunded mandate statute. It talks about no rule which mandates any county, municipality, or school district to engage in a new activity. So that's why I listed those three specific units of local government to mirror that statute.
But, Mr. Decker, there's probably no reason why we couldn't then throw townships in there. Do we need any other categories?
Mr. Chairman, you certainly could include township in there, and we could also include local government, but I don't know if that would help in clarifying the intent. But you're right, this amendment could stand on its own.
The reason for my question, Mr. Chair, is I'm thinking maybe of, roads. We may do something that causes townships to have to put up all kinds of whatever it is, signs or whatever. It could be increased costs, and that's what I'm looking at. Would they, that's why I was trying to include them. And I don't know if there's any other local-type governments which would be, some type of improvement districts, or if they're all considered in local government and municipalities, and maybe staff could help me there.
I suppose we could also think in terms of there are districts out there, water districts and drainage districts and all of those things,
yes.
Local government entities that might become involved. What if I just suggest that Mr. Decker and I just pursue that a little bit further and possibly add some additional governmental entities into that, just so we try to cover all the bases. If no one has any objection to that, I think Mr. Decker and I can probably handle that.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
No, I think that was, in fact, a good comment that I hadn't thought about. Maybe there's a broader statement that can be made that is inclusive of those governments under our purview. I don't know what that would be, but I would appreciate it if both of you would look at maybe some way to change that wording. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right, then, I feel there's a consensus to go forth with this proposed legislation next session, and that we will take a look at probably enlarging the governmental entities that are involved in subparagraph 9. Unless there's some objection to that, Mr. Decker and I will go ahead accordingly. Is there any other business that should come before the committee at this time? Seeing none, Mr. Decker, do you have any closing comments?
No, Chairman Hunt.
Again, Chris, thanks for your work in keeping us on track as far as the records and minutes are concerned. Appreciate what you're doing. At this time, then, the Chair will entertain a motion to adjourn.
I would like to also wish all of you the best of luck on the election coming up. We'll see you at the end of September. I move we adjourn.
Senator Valley seconds.
All right. We have a motion to adjourn by Senator Hunstead, a second by Senator Valley. All those in favor of that, just say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.